So we've been using this collection of essays by Sangharakshita as the basis, the conceptual basis for our retreat. And as others have said, it's a lovely collection of Sangharakshita as a passionate young writer on Buddhism and a monk living in India. And I was asked, for some reason, to give a talk on an essay that's entitled "Everything That Lives Is Holy." And I think this is Blake. It's a quote from William Blake. I should have looked up the context. I regret not doing that now. But I think... I'm not quite sure why people thought I'd be able to do a talk on this, but I was recently, somebody referred to me as a child of the universe, so maybe it's got something to do with that. This essay of Sangharakshita's is quite interesting. In fact, the whole book is really interesting because it shows us something about the roots of our movement. I was talking recently, just tonight, with some people about going back to the very early days of West London in the 70s. And this book actually goes more back to the 40s and 50s in terms of its the people he's writing for. Because he's in this book, I think, at least... he's talking to the generation before his own. You know, in this essay, this particular essay, he's talking about the ego sense, what he calls the ego sense. But he's talking about it in a way that it affected society in the 1960s, when most people were nominally Christians. They would mostly say, "I'm C of E," that would be the phrase they'd use, or Catholic, of course. But they nominally Christian, but moving away from it. There's a lot of questioning of that, and that was one of the big things that was happening in the 60s. So they were still unconsciously affected by Christian values and Christian attitudes. So there's quite a bit in Sangharakshita's. Sangharakshita is very critical of all that, you know. And there's quite a bit about it, about people who pride themselves on their virtue and use that their virtue as a way to feel superior to other people. And I'm not quite sure we don't really think in that way so much these days. It's a bit of a sort of 1960s thing. And he says, I'll just quote from this little essay, he says, "The conventionally good man is often a harsh and unsympathetic character, critical in the extreme of the faults of others, and highly conscious of the magnitude of his own virtues. While the conventionally bad man, or woman, he says, may, on the other hand, be sympathetic and unselfish to a degree which almost compensates for his or her deviations from the accepted standards of behaviour." And the whole language is from another era, really. The whole idea of the accepted standards of behaviour is kind of anachronistic. And I don't think we make this kind of division these days between good and bad people. Maybe we do in our heads a little bit, but it's just not the language. I think... Bhante Sangharakshita gets a bit more relevant when he talks about the group, society, saying that society regards certain actions as good or bad in themselves, like wearing a poppy, for example, or wearing a tie, or even wearing a kesa, you know, that sort of morality. I think that's still with us. In fact, I was recently given some feedback by someone at a certain London centre who'd heard that I didn't always wear my caser. Yeah. And they said that people there at that centre would be really confused if an order member didn't wear his or her caser. So I should always wear mine. They gave me a little lecture about it. So I listened. I didn't really believe people would be confused. But you can see there can be a kind of group morality that operates, a conventionality. And you get this in extreme forms in some right-wing newspapers. So I think Sangharakshita, in his essay, he protests against this kind of group pressure. He says that what's really important is not whether we follow convention. Just the phrase is so 60s, following convention. Anyway, he says it's not about that. It's whether or not we're acting selfishly. We're enhancing some kind of perceived sense of self. In other words, it's not about the externals of things, but the spirit of things. It's the inner intention, what you actually mean, what you're actually trying to do, consciously or unconsciously. And I think Buddhist ethics is all about the intention behind the deed, not the deed in itself. And Sangharakshita criticizes the attitude that if you do the right thing, go to the right place, wear the right clothes and say the right things, you are a good person, or a spiritual person, or an ethical person. He says that doing the right thing doesn't matter. That is not what he calls sacred or holy. Spiritual significance is everywhere. Spiritual significance is everywhere, and what really counts is to realise that and to see that. So that's how we get this phrase, everything that lives is holy. There aren't holy people in special robes or in special places. And he says, another quote, just to give you a sense of the language of this thing. Swinging thus the emphasis from the external to the internal, from the act to the thought, from the symbol to the thing symbolized, we can see that that religion is not confined to particular places, but that it saturates and sanctifies the whole of nature. That is, properly understood, not for the few only, but inevitably and inescapably for all. And that there is, to the eye of enlightenment, capital E, to the eye of enlightenment, no division between sacred and profane, but that, in the words of a great poet seer, everything that lives is holy. So you see that the passion in this, in the prose there. Anyway, I think I'm free to sort of, as Bodhilila said the other night, to riff on Bhante's phrase. And what strikes me is that he says religion or spirituality saturates and sanctifies the whole of nature. The whole of existence, I think, is potentially what we call sacred space. And I think the notion of what we find sacred is interesting. The Latin adjective sacer is pagan, it's pre-Christian. And perhaps you find some relationships sacred in some way. Perhaps relationships with a spiritual friend or particular friends or a teacher, perhaps. There's something in that relationship, to take that example, there's something exceedingly precious that can provide a door to awakening. And so the significance of that for us is very particular. And we don't want to only think of it as an ordinary relationship. It's got an ordinary side, but it also has this spiritual side or sacred side to it. And we can have the same sense of the sacred with certain objects. perhaps special books or ritual objects, like the Vajra and the bell that we were playing around with this afternoon. They're something really significant about these objects, or it might be a special book. And also, we can have the same sense with a place. A shrine room has a certain sense of, I don't know about this, maybe sacred is too big a word, but there's something very, very significant about a special room to practice in, you know. And perhaps, for some people anyway, there's certain times of certain days of the week, you know, certain times of the day, which for us are special, which are almost in this category, or maybe are definitely in this category of a sacred space. This is the time when I do this. You know, it's a special time. So I think Buddhist practice makes us more aware of this kind of dimension of things, and the sense that there are certain doorways to the unconditioned, to the ultimate reality, or just to reality, you know, to the Buddha, you could say. And I think in his essay here, Sangharakshita is saying that anything can be such a doorway, potentially. And I agree with that. I think we need to notice it when it is being a doorway, you know, and that's what we often don't do. And I think spiritual practice, like meditation, can give us more of the kind of awareness that makes us notice that this is significant. There's a significance here. This is a doorway. And I think this is not a trick of fancy. It's a tangible sense. I think when we experience the touch of the sacred dimension of life, to put it like that, there's a subtle thrill, if you like. We can feel fear. We can feel awe. You know, we can feel also a kind of a joy or a kind of wonder. And it can also be too much. It's also something we can withdraw from. We feel, I can't go there. And we can withdraw from it. So we can also tell ourselves that it's a delusion of some kind. We can have all sorts of reactions to this dimensions of things. And I think it's possible to have delusions about the sense of the sacred, definitely. And we can also pretend to ourselves that we experience it when we don't, you know. But I think it's also possible to have another kind of delusion, that it's all just our fantasy. It's all just a made-up fantasy. But it's also possible to have the delusion that everything is ordinary. That's another kind of delusion. And the delusion that everything is mundane, everything is without significance. But I think that is not the Buddhist view. I think Buddhist practice, through awakening the individual practitioner, through awakening us, you could say, awakens the world, awakens our sense of the significance of the world. And the sacred, you could say, is just another way of talking about deep mindfulness. You know, mindfulness fully practiced is this awakening of the world, awakening of a sense of the sacred. It's the direct truth of things. So this afternoon we were playing around with this image of Vajrasattva, an example of which we got on the shrine, the white figure there. And I know this image quite well, and for me at least, it really induces a sense of this sense that I'm talking about. Because I think contained in our perception of what's somehow sacred is also the feeling that sacred space is something that can be lost. Something that we have lost and that we need to regain. And I think what I mean is by that, it's often a bit of a missing dimension. We just feel that the world is very ordinary a lot of the time. I certainly do anyway. And we would like to enter a much fresher, more significant space. But how do we do that? How do we recapture that somehow? We recognise it when we see it, but we don't quite know how to get into that space. So I think the mantra of Vajrasattva, well, I think that all spiritual practice, I think I've conveyed this already, all spiritual practice does help us regain this. But the Vajrasattva, the whole myth of Vajrasattva is very explicit. I don't know if you know the 100-syllable mantra. We did the short mantra earlier on, but the 100-syllable mantra on Vajrasattva Samayama Nupalaya Vajrasattva Dveno Vatishtha Drittoba, the long one, it contains this idea of being separated from Vajrasattva, and it says things like, be there for me, love me deeply. And it's a bit of a dialogue between you and the Vajra nature, your Vajra nature. In other words, Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva representing you as you are essentially, you know, completely natural and pure and completely enlightened. And this just needs to be brought out. It needs to be brought out by the practice. So the myth of Vajrasattva and the long mantra of Vajrasattva sort of works with that. And there are phrases in it like purify all my karma, you know, purify all my karma. And it's like expressing our sense of disconnection, expressing our sense of unnaturalness and disconnection from deep connection with reality. And there is a sort of resolution of it in the laughter of Vajrasattva, the ha 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 ha. There's a bit of the mantra. I don't think everyone knows this mantra, but it goes ha 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 ho, like there's the laughter in the middle of the mantra. And this sort of represents the how absurd that you could have forgotten, you know, how absurd that you didn't get it, you know. It's just a joke, you know. You really are, in essence, potentially enlightened, and you had forgotten that. So the mantra sort of recapitulates that. Sorry, I don't have time to go into all that. Anyway, it's really explicit in that mantra, and the words suggest the feeling of being disconnected from our real nature. The process first of connection and then gradually reintegration with our real nature. Then finally you get this celebration of the unity that all beings have with that true Vajra nature, the diamond nature. And these are... the Vajrasattva meditation is one of the what's called the Mula Yogas, and Mula means a root. And these are special practices designed to connect us with the very basic truth of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and their emphasized at ordination. And this root, you're sort of getting down to the roots of spiritual practice, which is drawing out the best in you, or the deepest parts of you, if you like. This root is just our nature as human beings. As we are human beings, just have all these amazing qualities, and these amazing qualities and these amazing opportunities that we have as human beings is what makes awakening possible. And we just don't, it's hard for us to appreciate it, really. And this is our birthright, if you like. So awakening is what we're all about. So our lives make no real sense without awakening. So this is kind of celebrating this aspect of things. They don't make sense without it. Awakening is the core of our life, the root of our life. And when we connect with that truth, we are nourished. We feel nourished in a way that we don't get from anything else, you know. So when we touch that core of awakening, we refind our sense of the sacred. Big time, you could say. So, Vajrasattva is a purificatory practice. It's a purification in which we accept and we meet and we fully own our responsibility for all the poison, all the darkness and ignorance, all the imperfection in our life. We kind of really own that. Say, yeah, I'm like that. It's true. And we see that darkness in ourselves in the light of our real nature. So both of those things are there together. It's quite a strong practice. Our imperfections are seen in that light. We see our imperfections as just extras. They're not the real thing. So this is really encouraging. You see that all the crap, all the rubbish that we've built up are not really very important. They're not the essential part of us. And this is incredibly strong, incredibly liberating. The real thing is our Vajra nature. We don't have to associate ourselves with all that. We should own it, but not think of it as us. We should not identify with it. So that Vajra nature cannot be corrupted. It can't be lost, actually. It can't be disconnected from. We can feel disconnected from it, but it's always going to be there. We just need to realise that and accept it. So we might feel imperfect in various ways, inadequate in various ways, unnatural in various ways, in relation to enlightenment, but that's not necessary. Really and truly, we can let that wrong view go. And that process of moving away from the delusion of disconnection into awakening involves a process of purification of our view. And that goes incredibly deep. And it's physical as well as emotional and mental. It's physical. You feel it in your guts. You feel it in your heart. And meeting that and accepting that in a way gives great confidence, great self-assurance, you could say. I wanted to say a little bit how this links with the natural world, because I think this process, gaining confidence in our real nature, which is what Buddhism does for us, it is part of the natural world. It's not just an idea. It's the way things are. It's part of the natural world. The natural world is not different from our own nature. We're part of nature. We're all part of the same process of becoming. And awakening, enlightenment, you could say, is not something unnatural. It's not something against nature or that kind of idea. That's another bit of a Victorian or 1940s idea, I think. In the Buddhist viewpoint, nature is not lower. It's not like our lower nature. This idea seems to have become associated with some religions in the past. But nowadays, I think, again, that's a bit old-fashioned. I think we no longer see nature as something that needs to be overcome before we can awaken. I think we see it the other way around, actually. Nature needs to be embraced as part of the process of awakening. So I think this is certainly where Buddhism meets natural, what are sometimes called pagan values. We need to accept our real nature to enjoy and finally realize nature in its fullness as enlightenment, free from craving and aversion. And this is shown in certain Buddhist teachings like the positive dependent arising, positive paticca samuppada, and the Dhamma Niyama. Those of you who know about this stuff, you know, they go into the way that awakening unfolds in the individual according to natural laws in the universe. in the human psyche, put it like that. Anyway, just think for a moment about the scope and the range of your relationship with nature. If you think about it, nature is, for a start, your own brain, body and senses, and also those of others, everyone else. It's everything in the outside world. It is everything. All the forces of physics, chemistry, biology, etc. It's all of that. It's the fact of gravity. It's the weather. And then internally, it's hatred. It's anger. It's desire. It's love. And this is all nature. It's all naturalness, if you like. There's nothing else but that. Instead of using the word nature, we might just as well talk about reality. It's kind of talking about the same stuff. But just notice that when you do start using the word reality, it starts sounding a bit more conceptual and abstract. Whereas if we talk about nature, it just places our world in terms almost immediately of sacred space. And I think that's because the forces at play are much greater than ourselves. Nature is vast and awe-inspiring. Reality is a bit of an idea, it's a smaller thing somehow. Anyway, our attitude towards nature, I think, our personal attitude towards nature, and we all have one, is of crucial importance. I think our relationship with the natural world, it might be governed by a view that nature is somehow lower, or it might not, probably not. But even apart from all that, in day-to-day life, do we even experience what is happening as the natural world? You know, the exchanges that we have with the elemental reality that we inhabit, you know, with the hardness and the wetness, the hotness, the coldness and the movement and the space. This is the reality or the nature that we're in the middle of, that we've been born into. These, our exchanges with our world, are so bound up with our habits and our, what Buddhism calls our samskaras. We spend our time not in some kind of sacred space of nature, but in reacting with our likes and our agendas and our dislikes. That's what we actually do a lot of the time. You know, this sensation I like, that sensation I don't ever like. Objects like that are disagreeable, are nauseating, are lovely, are nice. Or whatever. You know, we're so busy reacting at this microscopic level to simple sensations that are coming up all the time that we almost never experience nature as it actually is, as sacred space. But when we make the effort to relax, I think, you know, we take the time to relax, again, our world becomes sacred in the way that I'm using this word. It becomes full of significance. It becomes a creative space. Maybe that's a better word than sacred. I don't want to spook you with this word, but it's creative. The world becomes an ideal environment for personal growth, you could say. Or you could say it becomes like a pure land, to use that kind of Buddhist language. Anyway, I'm nearly done. So, Dharma practice purifies our wrong, habitual view of the world as something mundane and instead introduces it again and again, you know, in meditation and other ways, as a Dharma realm in which everything that lives is holy, to coin a phrase, and every act is spiritually significant. As Sangharakshita says in his essay, just let's finish with another quote from his essay. He says, "A flower is sacred, a tree holy, if you look at it with an illumined mind. just as a religious observance is profane if you do it with a greedy, malicious, or deluded consciousness. It's better to sweep a floor egolessly than to meditate with the prideful sense that I am meditating. So there you go. So there's some reflections on everything that lives is holy. And it is. I believe that it is. Okay.